This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Listeners, you are currently tuned in to another edition of the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is Nick Duke here in our brisk, cold or warm, whatever the temperature may be outside in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, where our studio is located, as we bring to you another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys Off the Page. Now, Nick, since last week, I've taken the time to pen something for you, and I'd wonder if you'd like to hear it real quick.
Absolutely.
As we softly, brother, send my love to you, know that we will always be a brother too.
You're attempting to cross-pollinate our podcasting interests, Greg, and I like the effort, quite frankly. And speaking of cross-pollinating interests, you know, we often have wrestling references on this show, and I just want people to know that if you were right here in the L-shaped studios when we jumped into that longest-running weekly episodic bit, Greg's got a little Biggie hip swivel he's been doing with it lately, and I find it simultaneously confusing, disgusting, and arousing, and I don't really know what to do about that.
Would it be fair to say, Nick, that it causes your nether regions to become engorged?
It would be fair to say that it gives me feelings in my nether regions that some would consider to be unnatural.
Unnatural. And you know, unnatural is a good word to describe what we're here to talk about on this episode of Off the Page. Because as anybody that's anybody knows, right now Wonder Woman is tearing up the box office. Patty Jenkins' directorial debut in the superhero genre is currently the number one movie in America as we record. It is just destroying the critical charts. Everybody seems to love it. However, it's important to note that Wonder Woman media adaptations have not always been this well received. We refer not to the 1970s iconic Linda Carter Wonder Woman television series. No, no. We refer to a television series that never actually existed. An episode of a television series that was pitched out that was not picked up by NBC. And this was a pilot for what was proposed to be a 2011 Wonder Woman weekly series from David Kelly, the creator of Ally McBeal. And this was a series that was going to star Adrienne Palicki, who you may know from a variety of comic book adaptations. She was also in the unaired pilot of Aquaman back in the early 2000s, which we will probably review at some point down the line on the show.
Was she to play Mera?
No, I believe she was playing a villainous female character on the show.
Damn it.
And I know that is very distressing if that's not the case, because that's a good point, Nick. I didn't think about that. Speaking of points, that's another topic.
She had points all her own, setting way up high. Way up firm and high.
And she was also in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as Mockingbird, and did a wonderful job on that show, and then had yet another, and this has unfortunately been a career theme for her, another unaired pilot that was filmed called Marvel's Most Wanted that did not get picked up by ABC despite assurances otherwise. and kind of led to the end of the Mockingbird character for Marvel. So she's been in a lot of stuff, had a lot of success. She was in John Wick, the first one as well. I had a great role in that.
Oh,
been all around the world in a lot of different projects. But she was going to be our Diana in this one. And she was going to try to anchor this show that was supposed to be a big deal. David Kelly had a big name in Hollywood back in the late 90s and early 2000s, and this was going to be kind of his big comeback project to NBC. But as we'll discuss through the course of this show, things just did not work out for this project, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember hearing about this when it was in production, and we were all – you know, you got to understand, 2011 was a little bit of a different time period. If I'm not mistaken, Greg, I think we had just kind of heard that Arrow was possibly a thing that that might happen.
There was there was buzz about it, and Smallville had just ended, I believe.
Smallville had just ended, and really, other than Smallville, the idea of the live-action network superhero series wasn't really something that, you know, we had experienced in quite some time. And so I think we were all excited, but we all kind of wondered how a David E. Kelly superhero series was going to work. And I remember the first still of Palickian costume being universally derided and mocked online as looking fake and rubbery and kind of like a bad relic from the 1989 Batman movie, honestly, like something kind of out of that school of costume design. And it just seemed like negative publicity surrounded the production of this thing all the way through. And then eventually it kind of took on a legendary status when it was revealed that it was never actually going to see the light of day. And so in the years since, it's kind of gained this infamous cult-like status online. And I had never actually sat down and watched it until this week.
I
found myself, as I sat down and watched it, thinking, there's no way it can be as bad as people have made it out to be. And brother, I was wrong.
Yeah, this was a really interesting thing because, to be quite honest, I haven't watched many, if any, unaired pilot episodes of TV shows. It's just not something that's ever really come up for me to do. So it was interesting watching an unfinished product and that there were still some special effects that were supposed to be added in. Not really special effects so much as maybe some doctoring of special effects. And then there are a couple of scenes where it's like, add police cars. There's like a white title that flies across the screen.
Yeah, it's very much unfinished. But it, you know, when I say unfinished, a lot of people may be thinking, Greg, of something like, if you remember the work cut of X-Men Origins Wolverine that got released, that literally you could see the wires in almost every scene and none of the special effects were done.
Yeah.
In this, a lot of it is done. It's just – not a complete version.
It's probably 80 to 85% finished.
Right. And there's one instance where there's a notable overdub, a bad overdub of the line that probably would have been redone in post or something like that. So, you know, it's not 100% complete, but I think this is a fair representation of at least the tone of what this show would have been.
Right.
And it kind of gives you a glimpse of what maybe the overarching plot of the first season would have been.
And you'd assume this was the final version of the script, which is the biggest problem of all of it, as we'll get to. But before we get into the real gist of the story and laying out kind of what this show was about, let's give you the cast, because the cast is pretty incredible for a pilot for an upcoming show. You've got the aforementioned Adrienne Palicki as – we'll just call her Wonder Woman for now because we'll get into the unique take on this character in a moment. Elizabeth Hurley. Oh. Yes. The Elizabeth Hurley. Ravishing, baby. As Veronica Kale, the villain. Kale is a character, of course, that Greg Rucka has given a lot of attention to during his Wonder Woman run. Tracy Thomas as Etta Candy, who is Diana's personal assistant. Why does Diana have a personal assistant, you may ask? We'll get to that in just a minute. Pedro Pascal as Ed Indelicato, Wonder Woman's liaison to the police department. Carrie Elwes, yes, Carrie Elwes, who of course is known as from The Princess Bride, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and my favorite role of his, the stepdad on Liar Liar. If anyone remembers that film with Jim Carrey, he did the claw anyway, that's another story for another time.
Greg, speaking of liar, liar, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm going to tell you about a little funny liar, liar bit. I actually chuckled a little bit out loud. I was watching IFC the other day. I watch IFC sometimes because they show marathons of That 70s Show pretty much every day now, and as anybody who knows me, they know that I'm a big fan of that show. Anyway, they were showing an advertisement for Liar Liar. They were going to air it on IFC. Why would they air Liar Liar on the independent film channel? Not for me to say, quite frankly. But in any event, they were airing an ad for IFC, you know, for Liar Liar, saying they were going to air it all month. And it's clips from Liar Liar set to the to the presidential theme, to the theme of the office of the President of the United States of America. And then at the end, it pops up, Liar, Liar, all month long as it plays, you know, the dun-dun-dun-dun.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was funny. Chuckled out loud a little bit.
It was. That's interesting. That's very clever on the part of IFC.
But in any event.
Yes. By the way, hot take opinion. Hot takes are all the rage right now, Nick, in the
hot
world.
Takes.
I've got a hot take. Liar, Liar, Jim Carrey's best movie.
Ooh. Youth. Okay. Huh. I'd have to think about that. I would seriously have to think about that. I think for me personally, I would go Ace Ventura. But, I'd go Ace Ventura, I'd go Dumb and Dumber, and then I'd throw Liar Liar in there.
Oh, Dumber that's third. Fair. Yeah, I got to be honest, I blanked on Dumb and Dumber. Ooh, that's tough, yeah. I love me some Liar Liar, though.
You know what
I
the one is that I,
the love
that, I,
that, it deserves.
That I loved as a kid that just doesn't hold up, it seems like, every time I see it?
Ace Ventura 2?
Well, no, The Mask.
Every you know, time I haven't I, seen it I in a revisit... long time because I'm afraid it won't hold up.
Yeah, every time I revisit it, I find myself laughing less and less, and it just kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't know what
it feels like it would have a lot of – I haven't watched it in a long time, but it
you
feels
know...
like it would have a lot of Batman Forever sound effects on it.
You know, Greg, that is technically a comic book film. We should possibly revisit that for a future Off the Page.
Not a bad idea, Nick. And it's pretty easy to get on DVD, VHS, Laserdisc, whatever.
Right.
So, yeah, that's an interesting conundrum. All I remember about the movie in hindsight is a bunch of like weird like cartoon character faces and of course Cameron Diaz. But
oh good. Never mind.
We got enough to talk about in that department coming up. So, Cary Elwes, anyway, he's in the show as Henry Detmer, who runs the day-to-day operations of Themyscira Industries, which we will, again, talk about in just a moment. And then finally, a character you only see briefly in the episode, but who appears to be set up to be a recurring character going forward, Justin Bruning as Steve Trevor. Yes, that's Steve Trevor. In this case, Diana's former boyfriend who works for the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may be thinking, hey, isn't that kind of the take that Geoff Johns used in the Justice League ongoing series in the New 52? My answer to that would be no. Oh, and also, if that weren't enough, there are cameo appearances from several personalities, including Nancy Grace and Dr. Phil.
Oh, Nancy Grace, Dr. Phil, Jeffrey Toobin, pretty much all the CNN/headline news talking heads of the time. And just for the record, folks, you know, this isn't really readily available most places, so if you're going to go out and look for this, you'll probably have to resort to some, you know, less than reputable means to find it.
We would never do such a thing.
We would never do such a thing, and... In that vein, nor would I ever have the episode on in the background to remind me of the pilot as we're doing this episode, including such bizarre things as that god-awful opening, Greg.
I am currently watching the god-awful opening, Nick.
Now, which god-awful opening are we talking about? The chase scene or the random the random ethnic family who is playing a very stereotyped version?
Oh my, yes, with the mother whose acting is just out of this world phenomenal. What does it say? Tell me what it says! Okay, but that's not making any sense to the viewing public, or listening public in our case.
Right.
So let's explain what Wonder Woman is about. So do we want to just kind of do like we do sometimes and kind of explain the plot as it goes, or do we want to just give them an overview of what the show's about?
So, I guess let's just kind of do it as it goes, Greg. I mean, this isn't that long. It shouldn't take us long to work through this one.
I'm still on the family right now. Where are you?
All right. I'll run it back to the
I am currently at what's my number here? About 1 minute.
All right. Well, I'll run it back to 110 and start from there. Starting now.
Oh yeah, he's collapsing. He's got blood coming out of his eyes.
Now,
so
now, folks, we're not going to do this like our typical commentary track, just because we understand that most of you won't be able to see this.
Right.
So we're going to try to be a little bit more descriptive. So the show opens with a scene of a late teenage African American gentleman running down the street with an envelope in his hand, and he arrives at his home, and everyone's excited for him to open the envelope. He opens the envelope, and it turns out he got into this college he wanted to get into, and then he randomly starts pouring blood from his eyes and ears and collapses. And we cut from there straight into
A foot chase.
And I want to describe it to you folks the same way I described it to Greg on the phone the other day before he had actually watched the episode. How many of you remember the opening action scene of Casino Royale back when it came out? And it was an extended foot chase, but it kind of redefined what a foot chase could be on film. It took the foot chase and kind of flipped it on its head and had all these really interesting, innovative elements to it that made it, in my view, one of the most engaging foot chase scenes in the history of film. So imagine that, but without any of the innovative or interesting elements, and it's literally just Wonder Woman running down the street and occasionally hopping over a car while she chases a dude in a white jumpsuit for what literally, Greg, feels like 5 minutes. This feels
it really
like
does
it goes
feel
on,
forever. It's still
like
going
it
on as you're talking.
Yes. And I mean,
and this is a Wonder Woman who cannot fly, apparently, but merely glide. Now, this is the one part I did like. I did like the use of the lasso.
Yes, it's a bad special effect in this one, but I'm assuming they would finish it a little bit more in the future. And so she takes down this guy, and she instantly jams a syringe into his neck and takes a sample of his blood. So this is certainly a more aggressive Wonder Woman than you would expect.
Yes, a more aggressive, morally flexible version of Wonder Woman, who then comically slides the body of the bald man. Who is this the guy that plays Zaz on Gotham or not?
He looks a lot like him. I'm going to assume that it is.
Let's just assume it is, even if it's not.
And the cops just watch as, you know, the cops are angry with her, and she literally just walks away down the crowded street and no one does anything.
Making an angry face. And now we get the title. That comes across the screen.
This is one of the worst title logos in the history of title logos. I cannot believe this was the final logo. There's no way, right?
They surely would have worked on it, I'm certain. And now we see Wonder Woman flying in her jet that is not invisible. Just a jet. She has a small jet-like device that she drives in, personalized. Alan Dershowitz appears on the television screen, the real Alan Dershowitz,
yes,
to talk about how Wonder Woman needs to be arrested. You know, the basic scene that has come up a billion times since Dark Knight and Watchmen introduced the concept of talking head personalities questioning superheroes.
Oh, and there's Nancy Grace.
Our favorite.
Back when Nancy Grace was still relevant.
Yes.
Say what you will about 2017 and the general state of our pop culture, but at least Nancy Grace is no longer a regular television fixture anymore.
I want to draw attention. As Wonder Woman meets her friends, the aforementioned Cary Elwes, his character, whose name I've already forgotten, and Etta Candy.
Henry something or the other.
She delivers the line, yes, that referring to the guy that she caught. He was really fast. He ran like a cheetah.
Oh, God.
So that's their kind of bone to comic book fans.
Now, here's the interesting thing. She has flown to this office building and is walking down the populated hallways in full Wonder Woman regalia, and no one seems to bat an eyelash or find this odd. And here,
no.
Greg, is why here where we're going to explain, in my opinion, the by far the biggest issue with the entire concept of this show. I don't even know how to explain this accurately.
A triple identity.
Yes.
Go. Yeah, you go ahead, Nick.
No, you. Absolutely.
Okay, well, as we've mentioned, we've already seen her as Wonder Woman. We've already seen her as Wonder Woman, and we'll describe her look a little bit later. But also, the public knows that Wonder Woman is Diana. However, she is not just Diana of Themyscira. No, 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 no. David Kelly has decided that the "of" is unnecessary. So she is literally called, her name is Diana Themyscira.
Right.
So, okay, you might be wondering to yourself, so, okay, so Diana Themyscira is just another name for Wonder Woman, and she just walks around as Wonder Woman. No, 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 no. Diana Themyscira wears suits and dresses and things like that because Diana Themyscira is the CEO of Themyscira Industries.
Right.
A multi-million dollar corporation that Wonder Woman runs and operates.
And a corporation that has a multi-million dollar headquarter facility, a high-rise building that has living quarters for Diana in the building as if zoning regulations aren't a thing and buildings aren't classified as either business or residential.
Not only that, but in addition to this position that she has, the explanation that is given is that she needs money to fund her crime-fighting enterprises. And yet, thus far, and throughout the duration of this show, all we see her utilize are her jet, which you would think she'd have paid off by now, and her lasso, which was given to her, presumably, by the Amazons.
Presumably.
And her own fists. Although apparently she needs money to fund her collection of romantic comedies from the early 2000s and other romantic movies. Because in her third identity, folks, you see, at times it gets tiring being Wonder Woman, and she just wants to get away from it all. And that's when she puts on a pair of glasses, puts her bangs down, puts her hair in a ponytail, puts on a jacket, and becomes Diana Prince.
That's
lonely,
right.
Lonely city girl.
Because everyone knows that Diana Themyscira is also Wonder Woman, and she wants the opportunity to lead a normal life. And what sort of normal life things does that entail? Well, as you see in this scene, it entails sitting on her couch at her apartment, watching The Notebook, eating potato chips, and petting her pet cat while having a notebook-induced flashback to her own troubled romantic past with Steve Trevor. Good Lord.
I mean, this might be the least Wonder Woman scene that has ever been filmed involving Wonder Woman. I cannot imagine Wonder Woman sitting on her couch, eating chips, watching The Notebook, and crying about an ex-boyfriend. Not that there's anything wrong about that, by the way.
No, but it's not Wonder Woman.
For the character of Wonder Woman, it does not fit at all.
No, it does not.
It would be the equivalent of Wolverine laying in a bed, grabbing a photograph of an old lover and rubbing it. Wait a minute.
And shedding tears.
Wait just a minute. But
you know what does fit, Greg, though? That purple dress she's wearing right now.
Sweet shit, Nick. I'm glad you said it. Lord have mercy. Because, folks, let's go ahead and get that part out of the way. There are a couple of really good things about this show, and both of them are in the possession of one Adrian Palicki. Actually, all three of them are in the
And in just a few minutes, she's going to tell you directly what wonderful actions
she has. You see, this is not just Greg and Nick being misogynist assholes. This is Greg and Nick setting up for the next incoming plot description because the show itself draws attention to her. And listen, she's hot. There's no question about it. But,
she is. She's smoking.
But, again, there's more to this show because she is Diana Themyscira. She is Diana Prince. Although the only time you see Diana Prince is when she's inside her apartment with her cat not doing anything, except promising to set up a Facebook page. Because that's the
What
the
do
most
you think, Sylvester? Should Diana Prince join Facebook? One of the most 2011 things about this show.
Not only that, but for some reason, and I don't know if this has ever been the case, for some reason it is set up as a huge life decision whether or not she sets up a Facebook account.
Yeah.
Can you think of any reason, Nick, why this would be such a life-altering decision to make?
I assume they're trying to portray it as the equivalent of, like, you know, setting up an online dating profile or something. And they didn't want to just say online dating profile.
Well, you'd think they would have actually used, like, I mean, it's not like OkCupid or whatever didn't exist back in 2011, but...
Yeah, but Facebook had the name value, you know, that whole...
I guess.
That whole deal. But in the meantime, one of the aspects of the plot here is that, you know, we saw the kid at the beginning who started bleeding from his eyes and ears, and the mother has come to Diana and asked her to investigate, and without actually investigating, seemingly, Greg, she just decides that the CEO of rival Kale Pharmaceuticals is directly responsible for this kid's plight and decides to call a press conference essentially accusing her of major federal crimes with practically no proof. Such,
yes,
certainly a unique situation.
And as she's describing the victims, because the premise here is that her allegation is that Kale's company, whatever it's called.
Pharmaceuticals, I believe.
Pharmaceuticals. They are developing drugs that are a combination of steroids and HGH. And these performance-enhancing drugs are making athletes that are far beyond normal range of humans. But it's also causing them to die. It's giving them – you know, it's causing their hearts to explode, et cetera. And so she makes this allegation that Kale is targeting poor kids and killing them essentially with this stuff to test them on humans. And to get her point across, she shows the victims, all of whom are African-American, and says, look at these victims, all from ghettos, by the way. This, of course, was written by a white man.
Yes,
so,
yes it was.
Certainly a unique situation. And yeah, just a little bit all over the place from that standpoint. So again, the premise, this sets up the Kale versus Diana conflict here. But along the way, we also get to meet Etta Candy, who in this case is actually, as we mentioned, Diana's a CEO. Etta Candy is her personal assistant and has zero personality in the episode.
Do they ever mention how she became CEO of this multi-million dollar company?
No, nor do they mention why. Like, I mean, they set up a conversation in her flashback that she has with Steve Trevor where she mentions since she came over to Steve's world, she realized she can do much more good than she's currently doing. So she decides to go out to the West Coast for unknown reasons where she can – because for some reason she can save more lives in L.A. than she could in New York or D.C. or wherever. So she goes out there and apparently in the interim has become a multimillionaire who runs her own company that sells action figures, dolls.
Sells a variety of things that I'm not really positive on. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Greg.
Yeah. So we haven't talked about Cary Elwes' character yet. Who, with Cary Elwes, I always naturally assume that he's going to be a smarmy prick in whatever he's, you know, playing in. But he's really not in this. He's actually a disturbingly sincere platonic friend of Diana's who is her, you know, make sure that the company is running properly, but also is there to deliver expository dialogue for the audience, explaining things that are going on in the background of the show without being shown. So
I think he would have turned heel by the season's end if they had gotten a full season.
You think so? I don't know. He seems to really care for Diana a lot in his own.
Yeah, but he's I, like you. I just don't trust him. There's something about.
I don't either. There's something about. Maybe it's the hair too, because he's got 1990s corporate bad guy hair. Here we go. Here's the scene, folks.
He is also currently at the scene that we're watching now. Yes. They mentioned many times throughout the pilot, as Greg told you, that part of the way they fund Diana's crime fighting enterprises is by merchandising to include dolls. And so they're testing out the new prototype of this doll, which includes a chest that looks like it was drawn in a penthouse cartoon or something like that. The comically oversized breasts.
Breasts that are larger than Rob Liefeld's Captain America breasts.
And that's saying something. And so Diana is taking issue with that and feels like she's being objectified. But now, in the middle of feeling as if she's being objectified, she directly mentions, well, yes, I do have blessings. I have great tits and a great ass. She says that directly.
Yep. I thought her actual quote was something along the lines of – it's very similar to that, but I thought it was, as you know, Amazons are blessed with certain gifts, including, yes, I have perfect tits and a perfect ass. But damn it, that's not all I am, or something along those lines. Oh, no, yeah, it's your perfect tits, a perfect ass, and these perfect teeth. Look at how white my teeth are.
Oh, it's certainly a unique situation. And then
exactly.
She gives a pointed stare as she walks out of the room. And now here she is sitting and doing some some Batman-level brooding in her office.
As Cary Elwes comes in and just doesn't look trustworthy.
No, he doesn't. I don't trust him, Greg.
I don't either.
But yeah, so part of this
corporate here.
Part of this pilot is really trying to establish, you know, the reasoning for this setting that they have placed her in. And I got to say, Greg, the reasoning just doesn't hold together. And it winds up being the most, like, cringeworthy aspect of the plot. I mean,
Wonder Woman doesn't need money to operate.
This has a lot in common with Iron Fist in that I sat down to watch a Wonder Woman show, not a show where I watch boardroom meetings. Why must every superhero property have boardroom meetings now? Is that what people think that, you know, that's what the genre is all about? I don't know. I don't get it.
God forbid you have a romantic subplot in your show, though. That's a bridge too far for some people.
Oh, God.
So
speaking of romantic subplots, the way it's handled here, they show you a couple times throughout the pilot flashbacks to Diana's relationship with Steve Trevor and how it ended. And basically every time she's having a crisis of conscience of some sort or trying to figure out what to do, either Etta Candy or this Henry character, who we don't think is trustworthy, by the way, will blame her rash decision-making on the fact that she's lonely and is missing Steve. Basically saying that all of her problems are caused
because she doesn't
by her lack of romantic entanglement, which again is the least Wonder Woman thing of all time.
Yep, she just needs a man. That's what they're saying, essentially.
As Kevin Smith would put it, all any Wonder Woman needs is a good deep dickin'.
A Charles Dickens?
Oh, my boy.
But, yeah, so what we're getting at is this is not a particularly strong, independent version of Wonder Woman. Basically, the way that they try to show her independence is by making her act very rashly and
very aggressively.
Very aggressively and temperamentally. So they keep that aspect of Wonder Woman, which we've seen in some versions of Wonder Woman. But they lose
Crisis, most notably, in my mind anyway.
Right. But they lose the element of surety that she has, the fact that she's confident in who she is and what she is, and doesn't need the help of someone else. You know, doesn't need somebody else propping her up. Now we meet finally, Veronica Kale, Elizabeth Hurley's character.
There is a moment in this scene, by the way, Greg, that I am going to call out when it happens.
Call it out when it happens, my friend. In the meantime, we'll set up Kale comes here under the guise
of Lord. Okay, it's already happening, even more than I remembered. Elizabeth Hurley totally just gave Wonder Woman the once over. Like, she is giving her the fuck me eyes hardcore in this scene. And it quite frankly, I would suggest that had the show been picked up to order, it would have been one of the only aspects I would have been interested in seeing them follow up on.
Now, see, that's the thing. NBC shouldn't have picked this up. HBO should have.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, because, see, I'm gonna say it. Liz Hurley is still rocking it, my friend, at least as of 2011.
As of 2017, she's still rocking it. Liz Hurley never lost it. She doesn't still have it. She never lost it, Greg.
She never lost it, baby. God, you're right, Nick.
I am telling you, dude, she is ratcheting up the sexual tension in this scene.
Yes.
It had to have been intentional. Like, seriously.
This may be the best scene in the entire episode, actually.
It is the best scene in the entire episode, but I don't think it worked. I don't think for the reasons
for the reasons they intended, right?
No.
And I will say the casting of Adrian Palicki works for Wonder Woman, not just for the Greg and Nick being, you know, as we often are, but also because she is so tall. She's physically tall, and so she towers over Elizabeth Hurley's character. So that certainly works. But what doesn't work is literally everything else about this show. Etta Candy, just again, I mentioned it earlier, just does not have a character or a purpose in this other than just being a secretary who, again, just like Cary Elwes' character, just delivers expository dialogue. Like, well, the police have said that you can't go in there right now. Well, they didn't get the warrant yet. And no, she doesn't say it like John Wayne, but nevertheless, if she did, it would probably be a better show. The other thing is, now granted, I don't want to hold the special effects too much against it because it is a pilot. But
good Lord, these 2011, flying scenes. Yeah. Yeah,
these flying scenes in the jet are very bad.
And then the jet never does anything cool other than flies. And like, I'm trying to figure out why they felt the need to put extended scenes of her just zooming over the city, not seemingly headed towards any specific area or doing any sort of combat with the jet, just literally seemingly flying in circles. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
So
it feels like they in between scenes, like, because I think, no, literally.
You're right, Nick. I know where you're going with this, yeah.
The first scene was an action scene, and so it feels like they you know, did some costume adjustments to keep her chest region buckled down a little bit more. But this scene that we're watching right now, she's visiting a hospital, and it's all dialogue. And apparently for all dialogue scenes in this version of Wonder Woman, the costume just naturally lets her breasts pop out to a massive degree. Not that I'm complaining. I'm just saying I'm calling out an inconsistency with the way the costume is presented.
There are a number of physical inconsistencies with the costume in this episode, which we'll get to right now, in fact, because I'm afraid that we'll not be able to keep up when it comes up later. So the look of Wonder Woman here, and I don't know which came first, the design for this episode or the redesign for – I believe it was for the J. Michael Straczynski Wonder Woman run, where they redesigned her to have long pants instead of the traditional short pants that Wonder Woman's always had. And it was done kind of in the idea – the concept behind it was that we want to stop sexualizing Wonder Woman, so we're going to give her long pants.
And this show instantly undoes all of that by – she says to a police officer at one point, you're going to let me in that door because of what I'm wearing, essentially.
Yes, because in the show – yes, they have her in long pants, but they accentuate her bust to quite a significant degree.
And they make mention of the fact that she uses her appearance to get things she wants, essentially.
Whereas in the – exactly, which again is not Diana.
No.
That's Catwoman, yes. Poison Ivy, not Diana. So she – you know, again, I don't know if the comic did it first or if the show did, but she has these long pants. However, later in the episode, there's going to come a point when, you know, she's at the hospital right now and she's about to interrogate this guy that she captured earlier, another point that we'll get to. Later in the episode, she goes out for the big climactic action scene and without explanation.
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to make a bad joke. Just continue.
Without explanation. She is in the traditional Wonder Woman costume. Watch for it, Nick, because she has the short pants on, the trunks, you know, bare legs and everything.
I didn't even notice that, Greg, honestly.
Yeah, look for it when it happens. You'll see it. And there's no explanation given. It's not like she changed costumes. It's not like they built her a new one. Nope, no explanation. So
by the way,
now,
Greg, that guy that she chased down at the beginning, I'm pretty sure is either the guy who plays Dr. Zsasz or Tilda Swinton's ancient one from Doctor Strange.
From Doctor Strange.
I can't really tell at this point.
It could be. Could it also be the character Powder from the movie Powder?
Oh, God. He's not quite that pale.
So Wonder Woman just went in to interrogate this guy to get information about Kale's operation and literally broke his arm.
Yes, after she's already jabbed him in the neck with a syringe and not found what she was looking for.
And doesn't appear to understand why it's an issue for the policeman who is now walking with her trying to explain to her why you can't do that to a suspect.
Right.
And again, we've seen some aggressive versions of Wonder Woman, but this one feels a little bit almost on the sadistic side.
Absolutely. Before we move on from the costume fully, though, Greg, there's one more thing I wanted to mention. I don't know if it just stuck in my craw because of – you know, my daughter's recent interest in Wonder Woman, that kind of things. But I think the tiara is one of the worst looking things I've seen. It looks so cheaply made and fake and plastic that I don't even know what they were going for with this version of the Wonder Woman tiara. I thought it looked terrible.
I didn't honestly notice it, I guess. I mean, obviously I saw it was there, but it didn't really cross my mind much during the episode when it's juxtaposed with the very existence of Themyscira Industries.
Yeah, I know it's an odd thing to call out, but there are so many things about this show that bother me, and I just wanted to.
Oh my God! I just realized what Carrie Elwes's hair reminds me of. It's when Ric Flair got the schoolboy haircut in like.
Oh yes.
Good Lord! So, Lord Almighty. So, anyway, this show has elements of Ally McBeal thrown in it with the random asides, the single woman just trying to make it in the city kind of deal. It tries to throw us some action scenes here and there. Right now, Diana Themyscira is out to dinner with a crooked senator who is in the pocket of Veronica Kale.
With an awesome southern accent.
Yes. Every crooked senator needs a southern accent. I've always said that.
And they need to stab the table with their fork whenever they're in a dinner scene.
And again, this is another scene that just does not work for me. Like, it really doesn't. And
no, because it lacks any subtlety whatsoever. He's being an overbearing dick, and in response, she's being an overbearing bitch. And, like, it's just it's a version of Wonder Woman that, for all the efforts to make her relatable with the single woman stuff, whenever she's not doing that, she's completely unrelatable because of how aggressive and borderline sadistic she is.
Yes. This would be much better and more palatable to fans if this were a Catwoman show.
Yes.
Or even a Poison Ivy show, or even
a Batwoman show.
Even a Batwoman show, right. A Batwoman show in which Veronica Kale is both enemy and ally.
There you go.
So yeah, it's just not Diana. It really is not. Especially if you come and you see the movie where she is Diana right off the page. And then you go and you watch this, it's two totally different characters. But long story short, she eventually, gets information from Zaz, as we'll call him, and finds out about Kale's operation. Unfortunately, she later figures out that off camera, the boy that she visited at the hospital, who we saw at the beginning of the episode, has died. And this sets Diana over the edge and makes her realize that it's time to go and, well, to exact some revenge on Kale and her super soldiers that she's been building.
Ah, yes. Kale's super soldiers, all of whom are dressed in spandex. And not like spandex uniforms, like, you know, old cheesy superhero costumes.
No.
Literally spandex, like you might see in a mid-1990s infomercial about exercise equipment.
Yep.
Spandex, or like you might see Ben Stiller's character wearing in Dodgeball.
Spandex, like you might see worn by certain jobbers on WCW Saturday Night at 6:05 on the Superstation.
Absolutely. Sadly, no Zubas or Ribera jackets.
No. Nor any sightings of High Voltage.
No.
But nevertheless, in this show, we're almost to this point in the episode, actually. Wonder Woman goes and confronts these spandex-clad super soldiers and not only disposes of them in quick order, but literally murders several of them.
Yes.
Including one scene in which she throws a pipe through a man's neck, not in which what has to be an homage to Commando.
You know, it should be an homage to Commando, but I'm assuming that it isn't for some reason.
Well, there's no one-liner to follow it up. There's no, hey, let off some pharmaceuticals
there
or anything
was,
like that.
There was a wrestling tie in that scene, though, Greg. I don't know if you noticed it or not.
No, I don't think I did.
Several of the individual super soldiers in that scene were actually wearing Shawn Michaels banana smuggling referee shorts.
Hey, I like these shorts.
Some of the shorts in that scene on those guys, you talked about, I guess I never noticed Wonder Woman wearing the short trunks because I was noticing the banana smuggling shorts on all the super soldiers, and who knows what that says about me.
And the lead super soldier does look a lot like Ben Stiller's character from Dodgeball.
Mm-hmm.
Now wait for it, Nick. What we're watching right now, she is flying in her terrible plane to get to this underground facility where Kale's men are located. And she's about to land, and I want Nick to look very closely at the costume when she steps out and see how it compares to earlier in the episode.
Mm. Maybe she just has different versions of the costume, Greg. I mean, that's not unreasonable.
There's Ben Stiller / Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker walking alongside Veronica Kale.
Oh, he really does look like a 1995 WCW jobber, this guy. And he is about to get jobbed out big time.
Big time. Veronica Kale needs to work harder on her pharmaceuticals if
he
these
looks
are the
like,
best super soldiers she can come up with.
He looks like somebody who the Steiner brothers are about to drop on his head.
That would have made this show so much better, Nick, if Wonder Woman had gone to the wrong building and instead the Steiner brothers from the early 90s showed up.
I want you to look for the banana smuggling shorts. You're going to see them here in a minute.
Good God. Look at the steroids in this room.
Ahmed Johnson ain't got shit on these people.
That's right. And this guy's delivering his spiel about how this is going to be the night that he upsets Hacksaw Duggan.
And then he winds up getting the living shit kicked out of him by Ming.
Oh, here she comes. By Ming. Look, there it is.
Oh, the door has been... Oh, wow. Okay. Actually, you know... Wow. Oh, good Lord.
Yep. Yep. I didn't say it was bad.
You know, I'll allow it. I will allow this costumed inconsistency in this case. I got no issues with it.
I'm still looking for the banana smuggling short. Oh.
Oh, you'll see him. Come on, where are they?
Oh, I see him. I see him on the bald guy right behind.
Yep, there it is. There they are.
Right behind Ben Stiller. Yep.
Shawn Michaels' banana smuggling shorts. But in any event, like Greg said, she is about to literally murder people after an entire episode where she's basically interfered with police investigations, tampered with witnesses, obstructed justice at every turn. And after all this is over, because I don't think we're going to actually finish this thing, or at least I hope we're not, Greg.
She has no – there was a wire on that man. She has no regard whatsoever for the law, the justice system, human life, none of that. Right now, here's the pipe. Now she's about to let off some steam. Oh, not yet. I was a little off. She kicks this – what a terrible special effect on this dumpster. She punched that man in the face.
A shipping container.
Oh, a shipping container. My bad. It looks like a dumpster. Hey, wires.
Not great special effects on the
more wires.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, this is unfinished, sure, yeah. So let's not. Absolutely. You know, I'm not going to hold that against it.
Hey, I like that that shot for a moment. Wasn't bad. Oh gosh.
Decent.
Oh my. These guys are as effective as putties, basically on
yeah.
Power Ranger.
And they're supposed to be soldiers, and they're getting the living shit kicked out of them. But in any event, we have to remember, Greg, that our audience can't see this. So let's move on as difficult as it might
yeah.
be.
Yeah. So Diana performs judo moves and whatnot, and it's not a very good. She slides for no reason. It's not
she
a very.
Finally,
good
uses the bracelets. Though.
The bracelets. Yeah, that's. Yeah. I'll give him credit for that. And now we're watching her as she impales a man with a bloody lead pipe.
Good Lord, she's got him right in the larynx.
That was a brutal and violent scene. So eventually Wonder Woman – this is the most anticlimactic part. Wonder Woman confronts Kale in the hallway, and Kale says, "You've just entered my building, killed several of my men, and I have it all on camera. Welcome to the United States justice system or whatever." And then Wonder Woman's answer to that is to pick her up by the throat and punch her unconscious.
And then turn her over to the police. And then later on – the big climactic moment of this episode is they reveal that she is under Justice Department investigation, and there is a liaison from the Justice Department coming to speak with her right now. And who else is it but Steve Trevor, who instantly pardons her of murdering individuals, tampering with witnesses, breaking a man's arm, and generally just being a thorn in the side of the American justice system. In the first 10 seconds, he instantly forgives her because – her transgressions aren't what's really important in that scene, Greg.
No. What's really important in that scene is that Steve has gotten married.
And Wonder Woman is heartbroken. And
heartbroken.
Not an action scene. Not something actually having to do with Wonder Woman. We end the episode on the cliffhanger of her being distraught because Steve Trevor has gotten married.
Yep. And she finally signs up for Facebook. And she puts as her only friend on there, as Diana Prince, her cat, whose name is Sylvester.
Because it's a Warner Brothers property, after all.
Right. Now, I want to point out something else about the Steve Trevor scene when we get the reveal. He shows up, and Diana, who is expecting to be interrogated by someone with the Justice Department, shows up wearing nothing but a bathrobe for unexplained reasons.
Well, she did say, Greg, that she uses her looks to get things she wants. So,
okay,
I mean,
that's fair. That's a good
perhaps
point.
She was trying to distract the Justice Department liaison.
Perhaps so. And instead, she and Trevor make Steve Trevor make goo goo eyes at each other.
That's
for
the other thing in that
several
scene.
Minutes.
When she sees Steve Trevor, she instantly loses all of her composure, which again is one of the least Wonder Woman things of all time.
Yeah, they just kind of
stare at each
other.
She has that effect on Steve. Steve rarely, if ever, has that effect on her, based on my understanding of the dynamic.
Right, and they just stare at each other longingly, and then he fiddles with his ring, and she notices that he's married, and he's like, oh yeah, I got married. And
oh, one other thing I want to call out is this scene that we're seeing right now, where in a move that even our current president could appreciate, all of the employees of Themyscira Industries have gathered together to applaud their boss.
And literally, a group of women are dubbed in chanting, "We love you, Wonder Woman."
Yes, it is certainly
not unlike,
a unique situation.
Not unlike Phil Hartman shouting out, "I love you, Dr. Zaius," at the end of the Planet of the Apes musical on Simpsons. So,
that's great.
Yeah, just this is that's pretty much the episode. We've pretty much described it. A wild swing and a miss at the Wonder Woman mythos. And it makes me wonder if David Kelly, who has admitted to his credit that he didn't really understand the Wonder Woman character when he made the show, which begs the question, why would you make the damn show if you didn't understand the character? But this just feels like such a wild misstep, more so than – I mean, I've heard there have been many other unaired pilots in the past, some of which I've heard are pretty good. Aquaman, I've heard some pretty good things about. This is just so far off base. Yeah. I mean, this one is just...
It's one of those things where, like, the script was awful, don't get me wrong, and the way it was shot is pretty bad, and the plotting of it is pretty bad, but none of that could have saved the show, because the show, the entire concept of what this show is supposed to be is fundamentally flawed to the point where there was no amount of production that was going to be able to put enough lipstick on the pig, so to speak.
Yes. For people who complain about the CW DC shows because they are, quote, CW shows, this is the most CW superhero show that has ever been created.
This is more CW show than any CW show currently airing on the CW.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Of the ones I've seen.
This is the stereotype of the CW show. This is like, again, it's like Ally McBeal mixed with Dawson's Creek mixed with... The Guyver.
Oh, what a pull. What a reference.
So there is just a lot. The cast is really not to be blamed. Although I will call out that the woman that played the mother at the beginning of the episode, who pops up later and asks for Wonder Woman's help, is just an abysmal actor. She is just atrociously bad. Wooden, unconvincing.
I do want to throw some props to this guy who is playing Steve Trevor for his ability to hold it together in the scene, because she is throwing him the fuck me eyes now, and I can't believe he's able to maintain his composure.
You wonder how many takes it took, though, Nick.
Good Lord.
Because, I mean, that, you know, there may have been some early release issues if I were on set at that in that position.
It's like a porn set. They had a fluffer standing like right off camera to, you know. Anyway. Let's just move on.
Let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly about this episode.
Okay, the good. The casting, Adrian Palicki, Elizabeth Hurley, and Carrie Elwes. That's it. That's all.
Bad, everything else.
What I want to say is bad and what I want to say is ugly. The general plot of the episode, it would be, God, I don't even know, Greg. I don't even know where to draw the distinction.
I'll say the bad is the plot, the premise, the script.
The plot, but not the concept. And I know that may sound like an arbitrary distinction to some people, but it's really not. When I say plot, I'm talking about like the rise and fall of this episode. When I say concept, I'm talking about the fundamental premise on which they are basing the entire show, if it is picked up to the series, I guess.
Yes. And
the plot is bad. The concept, the premise, is among the worst things that's ever been put on film.
And I was going to put it in the ugly category. It's kind of sort of the same thing. The reductive nature of what it does to one of the most powerful, as far
female
as like
character,
you know, pop culture penetration female character in comics, the one that means the most to the most people, and it just really reduces her to a stereotype. So that's not good. It's not a good show. And ultimately, as we will probably make a recurring feature on these episodes in which we review these unaired pilots, which there are a few out there that we're going to try to get to in the future, I will say we can let's set it up right now, Nick. We can say should have been brought to order or was properly canceled or somewhere in the middle. And I am going to say they made the absolute right decision to axe this show and not.
Not only did they make the absolute right choice not to put this on the air, but they have also made the absolute right choice in subsequent years to try and keep people from seeing it, because it is every bit as bad as advertised. And it is embarrassing that Warner Brothers and anyone involved would have greenlit this shit in the first place to even go film this. Like, if you're trying to do a pilot for a Wonder Woman show, why even film this? There is no chance this is getting picked
up. And the thing is, if your whole deal was, hey, we want to do a superhero show with Adrian Palicki looking hot and being a struggling single girl in the street, there are characters that fit that description, but you can't make it Wonder Woman.
No. Like you said, a Catwoman show would have been brilliant.
Sure. Absolutely. But with all that being...
I can't believe neither of us pitched that on our five projects we'd like to see on the DC streaming service, by the way.
An Adrian Palicki Catwoman show?
A Catwoman show in general.
Hey, I'd watch it. And I think, as I've mentioned many times on this podcast, I think the time of Catwoman being a villain, per se, is over. I think we need to embrace the idea that she's been an anti-hero for the better part of 25, 30 years. And that's kind of how people view her now. So that would be cool. But nevertheless, this show, Better Left Dead, and if this show had happened and had been successful somehow, we may not have gotten the Wonder Woman movie that we just saw. So ultimately, the world's a better place because this was never seen.
Absolutely.
Well, with all that being said, folks, if you can procure a copy of this by whatever means you find.
Or have seen it in the past.
Let us know what you think of it. Let us know what you thought of it. Maybe you're one of the show's supporters out there. Let us know what you liked about it.
And why.
And why. And let us know your thoughts on the concept as we laid it out, what your pitch would be for a Wonder Woman TV series. And that's a pretty good topic, Nick, now that I think about it. Let us know what your pitch would be to make this show work. How would you fix it, basically? If you had to start from scratch and say, okay, it's 2011, let's pitch a Wonder Woman TV series that would be successful on NBC on a television budget. Can it even be done? Should it have even been tried?
And the rumor there for a long time that the CW was going to do one called Amazon that was essentially going to focus on her early life on Themyscira and maybe pull a Smallville and like – just barely start to delve into the very beginnings of her superhero career, but not really try to be a full-on Wonder Woman show.
Right, that was a rumor,
That should have been made. That's a good idea, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see why not. That could easily be done. You could even, I mean, that's probably the best way to go about it. You could even have done one where maybe she's just arrived to quote unquote man's world, and so she hasn't really done the whole Wonder Woman thing yet, and she is trying to figure out what her place is, you know, fish out of water type deal. Maybe that could work. But I like the idea of the Amazon show better. So but let us know what you think, folks. Drop us a line on Twitter.
Greg, think of the romantic subplots, the CW romantic subplots on an Amazon, a Themyscira set show. Just picture them in your head for a minute.
Can we keep the same cast from this show?
I think we could work something out. Although let's not act like the CW casts are ever hurting for attractive
point.
Young people in their
that's
in their
a
ranks.
Good point. People like Stephen Amell.
Stephen Amell. Emily Bette Rickards.
Yep.
Melissa Benoist.
Yeah, that's a good point. Candace Patton and Danielle Panabaker.
Adriana Lima.
Lana.
Fair. Decent assortment of talent, some might say. I wonder who signed them.
Probably the same gentleman that first brought in the idea to bring in Dr. Death, Steve Williams.
Probably the same individual that has decided that, you know, the accumulated filth of all their sex and murder will fall up
now.
About their waist.
We don't want to tell tales out of skewel. The man who brought in the finest ass in professional wrestling, the perfect ass of Steve Dr. Death Williams. Oh,
folks,
boy.
We have thrown the format sheet out the window at this point.
Let us know what you think about all of this mumbo jumbo we've talked about on Twitter at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. And, of course, we have Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Join our page. We will bring you in. You will discuss comics with us. We will have laughs. We will have fun. We will have debates. It'll be a great time. And also, of course, we have email addresses. GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com. NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. Please replace the Condom Depot spam emails that are currently filling our inboxes. And with that being said, folks, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we've got reading, watching, and arithmetic. Oh, and also the rundown. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Pari, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
ladies and gentlemen, for the second part of our off-the-page edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Greg Phillips, Nick Duke, here in Vancouver, BC, in our L-shaped studio, just for you, bringing you all of the best information from the world of comics. But before we get to the rundown, we're going to get to what's become a bit of a lackluster segment in recent weeks due to the lack of television on right now. But it's a segment that we like to call... Yes, reading and watching. And we're going to start off this week with the lowest part of this denominator right now, the lowest common denominator between us right now, which is watching. And yes, I'm aware that that term, lowest common denominator, did not mean anything in that context. I don't know why I said it, I just did. But nevertheless, I have been watching a few things recently, comic book related. Would you to hear, Nick?
Sure, yeah. What have you been watching? Because I ain't been watching nothing.
Well, I watched with my parents, who visited me this week in my luxurious Dothan, Alabama apartment. We watched Doctor Strange on Netflix, which they had not
seen.
Hey,
I actually rewatched that on Netflix over the past week as well. I just didn't think to mention it because we had already given our thoughts last year. But yeah, I rewatched it as well.
They had not seen it before, and they thought it was pretty good. Yeah. I would say that's fair to say. I think pretty good is a good description of it. Not bad.
Yeah.
But I will say I still have issues with it. I think it drags.
I would say that the elements that I enjoyed, I probably enjoyed even more on second viewing, and the elements that I didn't care about, I cared even less about on second viewing. I don't think there was anything in the movie that actively just, like, bothered me or took me out in any real way. But I will say there was a lot of stuff that I was just kind of nonplussed by. I think the visual effects are still incredibly incredibly innovative and still incredibly effective when used. And I think
if a little less effective on the small screen.
On the small screen, for sure. Yeah. But, I mean, that's the way, you know, it's always going to be. And I think that Chiwetel Ejiofor is amazing as Mordo.
Agreed.
And I think Cumberbatch is good. Not great. He's good.
Agreed.
That being said, I could not care less about the Rachel McAdams romantic subplot.
Which is a shame because I like her a lot in this movie. I think
she's trying.
She brings some personality to the character that a lot of, sadly, the Marvel female love interests have not had, but
there's no, the material isn't there. That's the problem.
Yeah.
She is busting her ass to give a great performance.
Did not
she's incredibly.
About... Oh, go ahead.
She's incredibly charming and likable. It's just that there's nothing there for her from a script standpoint.
Yeah. And I don't care about Lashif as the villain. I'm sorry. It's not a good villain, not an interesting villain at all to me. I don't think they gave enough of his backstory. I don't think they gave us any reason to empathize with him or to hate him.
No.
So, you know, not a lot to that.
To me, he's almost meant more than to be the main villain of the film, that he's really meant to just illustrate how the Ancient One in this universe is not like some infallible person. I think that is really the entire point of his character, and he serves that purpose, but in terms of carrying the overall plot of the movie forward, he doesn't really do much in that regard. I think that's the reason why the real climactic showdown isn't even with him at the end. It's with
Dormammu.
And that scene, I think, still holds up. I like that scene a lot.
Yes, that's a great scene, but again, I wish I cared more about Dormammu. I wish that the movie had been establishing Dormammu as the big bad instead of building Lashif's character as the big bad, or switching the blame onto the Ancient One, because Dormammu just shows up at the end, and it's a great scene. But again, there's just not enough there. And again, I'm not saying it's not a bad movie by any means.
No.
It's a solid movie. It's just, you know, it remains probably one of my least favorite of the Marvel entries, I would say.
I think that's fair. I think I enjoy it more than you do, but I think it's still, because the Marvel Cinematic Universe has such an outstanding track record at this point, I think it would be in my bottom five. I don't know where exactly it would rank in there, but it would be down there. Down where, you ask? You know where.
You know where.
You just gotta, you know, I can't really say with any certainty exactly where until we get there way down the road in our Hard Travelers for Hire series.
That's right. See, that's how you tease them and get them wanting more, Nick. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You tease something for the future. Also, the very next day, we went and they had not seen Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, so I finally got to see it for a second time, and on the opposite end of the spectrum from Doctor Strange, just as good the second time, if not a little bit better. I mean, it's so... so good. This was such a fun movie. I picked up a few little things here and there during this watch that I didn't pick up the first time, jokes that I might have missed the first time around. So much to love here. Kurt Russell is tremendous, instantly one of the best Marvel villains, kind of by default, I guess, but he was excellent. And everybody brought their A game here. And for what it's worth, both of my folks agreed with us, Nick, that our boy Big Dave stole the show.
Big Dave bringing the comedy.
Absolutely. And with that being said, that's all I've been watching. So I guess that means it's time for reading, my friend. And I do have some reading this week, but I only have two issues that I can talk about, sadly.
All right. Well, I guess that means that I'll be starting again. And since I'm starting, I'll start wherever the hell I damn well please. And I will start, sir, with my bottom book of the week. And this was a really another great week for comics. I read, I believe, 9 comics that I would consider to be really good, and then I read one that was just kind of okay. And so by default, the kind of okay one is my bottom book of the week, and that is the Wonder Woman Steve Trevor special that they released last
week. Didn't even know that existed.
In conjunction with the movie. It's written by Tim Seeley. Yeah, the art is done by somebody named Duce. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that. But in any event, it's fine. I don't think Wonder Woman is very well written in her couple of scenes here. And other than that, it's just kind of a paint-by-the-numbers military operation story involving Steve Trevor. And the art's okay. The writing's okay, except for the writing of Wonder Woman. And yeah, so not really a ton to write home about here. Not so much bad as it just is wholly unremarkable to me.
Gotcha.
And then moving on to my top three, starting off with my number 3 book of the week. I think this is going to come as a little bit of a surprise to you, Greg, that this is only at number 3, but I'm going with Batman number 24 at number 3. This is the issue entitled Every Epilogue is a Prelude, and it features
my most anticipated comic of the week.
The event that we discussed last week on this very airwaves, the proposal of Batman to Catwoman. And while the proposal scene in the last 3 pages is everything you would want it to be, I didn't really buy the event that made Batman realize what he needed to do. And the event is an extended conversation with Gotham Girl, who that character has worked more for me, I think, than she has for you to this point, Greg. But even in this one, I found myself just kind of underwhelmed by, I didn't buy the idea that these words, this conversation with Gotham Girl would spur Batman into this momentous action. I didn't think that came across very well. So, honestly, basically for the David Finch artwork and those last three pages alone were enough to get it onto my top 3 spot in a hell of a week for comics.
Excellent. Good to hear. I'm very much looking forward to that. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and jump in with my number 2 book of the time period, and that would be Wonder Woman number 16. And this is by Greg Rucka and Bilquis Evely, I believe, is the artist on this one. And it was the first part of the God Watch story, which is kind of telling the story of Veronica Kale's team. And how it came to be. And this, I thought, was a very good introductory issue to what you can expect going forward in the storyline, kind of setting up the paths that are you finally start to see how the year one and early years of Diana are going to intersect with her current day. And yes, I know I'm quite behind on this book. And it's a unique take on the character. It's a unique take on this Veronica Kale character, and actually finally started to make me care, because I got to be honest, Veronica Kale really wasn't doing much for me throughout much of this run, and now finally I feel like I'm getting something to buy into her with, a reason to bite on her character, so to speak. So yeah, Wonder Woman number 16 delivered in a big way for me. Really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Good to hear. My number two book of the week is Aquaman number 24. This is the final issue of the bi-weekly publishing schedule for this book, because starting with issue 25, it's transitioning to a monthly book with artist... Oh boy. Artist... taking over on art. And so this is the farewell issue for Scott Eaton on art. But this is an outstanding issue, Greg. This plays off all the themes that Dan Abnett has been building and laying the groundwork for throughout this run. We've talked about the themes of nonviolence and how diplomacy and politics and political, seeking a peaceful political resolution to things have kind of been Aquaman's main drive throughout this title. And all of that kind of comes to a head in this issue, where every character, every side character that he's kind of had – that he's kind of featured throughout the run is faced with choices, and they all have to make choices about where their loyalties lie going forward. And it sets up a new status quo for Arthur. It sets up a new status quo for Atlantis. And it's one that I hope is going to kind of be a slow burn that's going to play out and resolve itself over like the next year or something. Cause it really has a lot of potential, I think. And it leaves you on a little bit of a cliffhanger that has you wondering what the status quo of Mira is going to be when we come back in issue 25. So lots of mysteries, lots of intrigue. I am loving this Aquaman book, and I can't wait to see Abnett's writing paired with that art. Because if you've seen the preview pages for the from the aforementioned new artist, you know that's going to be one of the most mind-blowingly beautiful books in comics when it starts next month. So looking forward to that. But Aquaman 24 just continues an outstanding Aquaman run.
Excellent. And I'm very much looking forward to catching up with that, of course. As for my number one book of the time period, it is actually going to also be a Wonder Woman title, and that is going to be Wonder Woman number 17, which is the second part of the Truth storyline. And this is one of the most heart-wrenching issues of Wonder Woman to date, and maybe the best of this Rebirth run. This features Barbara Ann Minerva being forced to make a tragic decision regarding her status as the Cheetah, and she does it not out of selfish means, despite how it's probably going to be interpreted by Steve Trevor and potentially others. She does it to protect her friends, Diana, Steve, and Etta Candy, from this group that is run by Veronica Kale, the God Watch group. And the way that she arrives at her decision makes sense. It hurts. It hurts you as a reader, because you've grown to care about Barbara to this point. And there is a wonderful panel from Place to Be Nation pop favorite Liam Sharp near the end of this issue, when the God Watch group is attacking Steve and Etta and their friend, and suddenly the attack stops. And there's no words to explain this, but Etta breaks down crying, because she knows the only reason that that group has stopped is because Barbara must have given them what they wanted, which is her to become the Cheetah again. So this is just a heart-wrenching issue that I think encapsulates what is so great about this Greg Rucka, Liam Sharp, Nicola Scott, Bilquist Evely run of Wonder Woman comics. Highest recommendation.
Yeah, I knew you would love that when you got there, so glad to hear I was right about that. My number one book of the week, and it comes as no surprise probably, Greg, because it seems like every time a new issue of this title is released, it is at or near the top of my list, and of course I'm going with Jessica Jones number 9 as my number one book of the week. I knew you were going to do that. Continues the Lies of Maria Hill storyline, but it also brings a conclusion to the ongoing marital strife between Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. And the way it is brought to a conclusion is so beautiful and so realistic and so accurate for, you know, the way relationships work in the real world. It's not always a situation where you sit down and hash out everything that each of you did wrong and somehow come to some beautiful, you know, wonderful consensus on exactly what the problems were. Sometimes you just have to understand that there are certain aspects you're not going to agree on, and you acknowledge that and you move past it anyway, because your love for each other is more important than who's right or who's wrong in certain situations. And Bendis brings that to the forefront so beautifully in this book. I had so much concern when this was first coming out about how he was talking about how he really wanted to play with that Jessica and Luke dynamic, and kind of had us all concerned about the future of the relationship. But after reading this book, I am more convinced than ever that under the guiding hand of Brian Michael Bendis, that marriage is not going away anytime soon. And I would argue it should not. It is beautiful. It's perfect. It's one of my favorite relationships in all of comics. But it's not just that scene that puts this at my number one spot. The opening of this book is also fantastic, as Jessica finds herself confronted by Sharon Carter and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Bendis shows you throughout the scene there are ways for her to get out of this. She could conceivably talk her way out of this. And yet Jessica's inability to not be a sarcastic bitch at all times winds her up in jail. And it's a hilarious opening that sets the stage for her and Luke's reconciliation. And I just love everything about this book. So major props to Brian Michael Bendis, Michael Gatiss, and Matt Hollingsworth, who were the art team on this one. Jessica Jones continues to knock it out of the park each and every month.
You might say that it's a relationship that is not ugly, but very, very beautiful.
How would a certain pro wrestling announcer say that, though?
Now, quite frankly, some might say that, in their opinion, the relationship might not be ugly. Might not be ugly to you. It might be very, very, by God, beautiful.
Indeed.
More of that in the future.
Absolutely.
So on to your quick hits, my friend.
Yeah, I got a few of those. I'll run through those real quick. Spider-Man number 17, one of the stronger issues of Spider-Man in recent memory, kind of delves into what the current psyche of Miles is like and why he's feeling the way he's feeling. And it shows that he's got a great supporting structure around him that's trying to help him through a tough time. And in true superhero fashion, he's just a little bit too stubborn to accept help right now. But they approach it from a really interesting angle, in my opinion. Star Wars Darth Vader number 1. I know this kind of caught some mixed reviews online, but I really enjoyed it. This is basically picking up right where episode 3 left off. I'm going to tell the story of the early days of Darth Vader. And so I enjoyed it. And it's kind of set up what the plot of this one's going to be and the goal Vader is seeking. And I think it's an interesting story to tell personally.
Who is the rightist on that one? Is that Charles Soule?
Charles Soule is writing it, and an artist is named Common Coley. I'm not really familiar with him. That was the one aspect of the book I wasn't crazy about was the art, but I still enjoyed it nonetheless. Green Lanterns number 24 brings a conclusion to the Lost in Space storyline, where each of our respective Lanterns, Jessica and Simon, passed their training from their mentors with flying colors. I don't want to say too much else because I want you to get to read it for yourself. Superman 24 continues the Black Dawn storyline. One of my favorite issues of Superman in recent memory, really liking this character of Manchester Black, who I knew nothing about coming in, but Pete Tomasi does a good job of kind of summing up what he's all about in this issue. And then finally, Green Arrow 24 brings a conclusion to the Rise of Star City storyline. While I enjoyed this issue, I thought it burned through that conclusion way too fast for my liking and probably should have stretched this story out another issue. I thought things moved at a little bit too rapid fire of a pace for me as someone who's a fan of the decompressed story.
You would prefer it to move at a
medium pace.
At a medium pace.
Absolutely. So those are my quick hits.
Very good. And that brings it in to reading and watching, and that means that it is time for oh my gosh, Nick. I thought we were going to get through a whole episode without this ticker going off, but
now what would be the point of doing the podcast if that were the case?
Oh my gosh, let's see what we got here coming across the ticker machine here. We've got let's see, 8977 Highway 27, Horse Property in Henry County, Alabama. That's not it. What do we have here?
Phil Paramore Network.
Sonic, transform your summer sweepstakes. Oh, I'm interested in that, but that's not what we're looking for here. Ah, I found it. Ho Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
And consequently still in the WrestleMania 33 program.
Wow, you heard it here first. Remember those old MTV news ads? You hear it, dung 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 first. Well, that's us with Ho Ho
I'm Kurt Loder.
Exactly. Do you think, Nick, that we could get Kurt Loder to deliver our Ho-Ho Loon updates when they come through?
If he's still alive, he can't be doing anything else.
That is a wonderful point. We're going to have our people reach out to Mr. Loder.
His people.
And see if we can get him right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And if not, we'll try to get a reasonable Kurt Loder facsimile on the show. So, with that being said, let's move on to our weekly rundown of news and notes throughout the comic book world. Let's move on to...
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
That remains wonderful every week, an homage to the greatest of American bands. And with that said, we do have some somber news, unfortunately. Not to bring down the spirits too much, we actually do have some somber news to lead off with. Everyone's heard about this by now, but one of the most iconic DC Comics figures of all time, Adam West, who of course portrayed Batman in the classic 1960s Batman TV show, I believe on ABC. Also the mayor on Family Guy, playing himself, a cartoonish version of himself on Family Guy. Adam West passed away last week at the age of 88 and had just a remarkable career. Had a long run in Hollywood. Obviously, his most iconic role is as Batman, and he never hid from it. He never ran from it. He got typecast, certainly, and there's no doubt that it probably impacted his career in some ways that weren't all that positive. But he never once ran from the role. He embraced it, had a great guest spot on The Simpsons in the early 90s, poking fun at himself, was never afraid to poke fun at himself, and never acted ashamed of the fact that he was Batman, even though he poked fun at himself. So what a loss for our community.
Absolutely. Kind of hard to figure out what else to say that hasn't already been said, but I would argue probably to the mainstream public, still the actor that is most associated with Batman. If only because it's been out there for so long and the show has endured in a way that I don't really think anybody ever expected it to. You know, it still holds that place in pop culture. It's still talked about. I know a parent, or, you know, for our generation, our parents would always talk about watching it as kids, you know, and it was something that was always around, even in our lives. I remember watching it. It was my first exposure to Batman, was watching the old reruns on the Family Channel. And it was, when you talk about Adam West himself, it's one of those examples of comic book fandom and mob mentality kind of deciding at a certain point that Adam West had ruined Batman and had been a disservice to the character and was, you know, in some way personally responsible for the dire state of the character on film at a certain point. And the beautiful thing is that in the last decade or so, it's like the fandom realized they were wrong, and probably in large part due to Family Guy, and in large part due to the growing realization that there are valid, varied interpretations of almost every longtime comics character, it's like the fandom apologized and re-embraced him in a big way. And I'm so glad that that happened. You know, if Adam West had tragically died in like 1991 or 1992, Greg, when people were still in that oh my God, you know, the 60s show ruined Batman. It took us 20 years to get a real version of the character up on the screen. I don't think the outpouring of love and support would be nearly as unanimous as it has been in 2017.
I agree completely with that, Nick. And I think that what happened is fandom collectively at a certain point finally got the joke.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term. I think for years people labored under the delusion that Batman was supposed to be a serious show that just came off unintentionally hilarious. And in fact, what you find when you go back and watch it,
it was all intentional.
It was brilliant. It was a flat out comedy. Whether people got that at the time or not, I can't say. But if you watch it, there's no way to view it as anything but an intentional comedy. And it's brilliant. It is. The cast is wonderful in their comedic timing, and Adam West is forefront of them all. And he showed that, like you said, when he went on to Family Guy and forever changed the way that I look at movie theater popcorn. So just a tremendous loss, but he will be remembered forever. And it's actually inspired me to go and find and watch the long ballyhooed TV pilot that he did in the 90s for a cop show that was written by Conan O'Brien and Robert Smigel. So I'm looking forward to watching that at some point in the next couple of weeks.
I would recommend to anyone, even if you're not a regular listener to any of Kevin Smith's podcasts, Kevin Smith does a podcast called Hollywood Babylon with his compatriot, Ralph Garman, who you may know from Joe Schmo Show, if you ever watched that back in the day, or various other bit roles he's done throughout his life. But Garman was a lifelong 60s Batman super fan. From childhood, has one of the largest collections of memorabilia from the show. And he told the story on the most recent episode of how Adam West, to him, basically disproved that old saying, you should never meet your heroes. And he tells the story of how when he moved to Hollywood, he had the opportunity to meet Adam West, and they became close friends over the last 25 to 30 years, and that Adam West was as great of a Batman as he was equally great a human being. So it's a really, really moving eulogy to his close friend. So if you have the opportunity to go check out the most recent episode of Hollywood Babylon, even if you just listen to that part, I would highly recommend it. A moving eulogy from a guy who clearly knew him better than any of us could ever hope to. So,
absolutely. And let's stick with DC Comics as we move on to our next big news item. And that is in what we like to call the DCEU corner. And for once, we have news that is neither good nor bad, just kind of news.
Interesting, yeah.
And in this case, that news is that Warner Brothers is angling to begin production on Batgirl and Justice League Dark as the very next films right after the currently filming Justice League and Aquaman. And this is according to The Hollywood Reporter. Now, this would put it ahead of several projects that have already been announced by the studio as part of its big unveiling plan that came out early last year. And that plan included things such as Shazam, Cyborg, and, of course, Green Lantern Corps.
You know what? You know what's interesting about this report, Greg? The first thing that sticks out to me?
Oh, what's that?
What's interesting to me is not so much the films that are mentioned, but the one that isn't.
And that is The Flash.
Not even mentioned in this report. Is it an oversight on the part of the writer? Possibly. But could it be a sign of something more where that film is now considered to be so far off the radar that it's not even worthwhile to discuss it? Food for thought.
Yeah, food for thought for sure. And quite honestly, if that's the case, I can think of worse things because I'd rather them not do the Flash movie yet than half-ass it and do a bad one, which is kind of the direction it feels like we could be heading in.
Can we just do the crisis in the Justice League? I haven't even seen Justice League yet, and I just want them to do a crisis in the second Justice League movie, kill off Ezra Miller, and bring over
Grant Gustin.
Grant Gustin from the TV universe. Like, I mean, it's...
Then we lose the Flash series, though.
Not necessarily.
Oh! Have him planet hop.
Or not planet hop, just do it. I mean, do the Flash show and have him appear in movies as well. Like, I don't understand the... You know, but that reopens the old can of worms. What we should really talk about here is the idea that Batgirl and Justice League Dark are going to hop into production ahead of films like Shazam, Cyborg, and Green Lantern Corps. And what I would say is, in the case of Batgirl, that makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
You got Joss Whedon already working on Justice League. It's clear he's psyched about the project. He's talked about it in recent interviews. He's ready to go.
Strike while the iron is hot.
Right. With his name attached to it and with the massive success of Wonder Woman, why not do it now? Absolutely jump on it now. I have no issue with that. Justice League Dark, however, currently doesn't have a director, doesn't have a cast. To my knowledge, doesn't even have a final script. So the idea that they're looking to fast-track that one is a little bit surprising to me. I can understand it being placed ahead of something like Cyborg in the queue, but I would think that a movie like Shazam, which has been talked about and had The Rock attached for years, you know, 2 years now, would be a higher priority than Justice League Dark. I would even like to think, and I'm sure I'm wrong in
let's not go too far out on a limb here, Nick.
I would like to think that Green Lantern Corps, given the fact that you at least seem to have a premise and the assumption that we're all working off of is that Hal Jordan and John Stewart are the co-leads of the film. Given that you seem to have the general premise of the film in your head, I would think that would be ahead of Justice League Dark, but, you know.
At this point, Nick, I will believe that a Green Lantern Corps movie is being made when I see still shots of the production, in production, and not until then, because it clearly isn't that much of a priority to them. So that's beside the point. But I think part of this, I think you're right, Nick, the fact that Justice League Dark doesn't have a director, doesn't have a script, doesn't have a cast, that's all concerning, and I agree with that because, you know, it's weird why they're so hell-bent on fast-tracking that, especially since none of the characters have proven any kind of proven box office draw apart from, you know anything more than Shazam or Green Lantern would have. But
I would say perhaps the appeal of Justice League Dark is that it's one of the few films that DC is planning that I think can come across as wholly and completely different than anything Marvel has attempted to do. I think Justice League Dark really leaning into that mystic and occult side, even more so than something like Doctor Strange did, could really be considered a unique property in the superhero genre.
True. And I think part of this is part of my trepidation and my kind of meh feeling about it is just that's kind of how I've always felt about Justice League Dark. It, as a concept, it doesn't really appeal to me, I guess. And so, I liked the Infinite Crisis. What was it? The Shadow Watch. Yeah, the way they did Shadow Watch and the Infinite Crisis build up. I enjoyed that. But those were, you know, lower tier characters. Justice League Dark always felt very randomly thrown together to me as a team.
Yeah, I don't think we're getting a movie with Detective Chimp in it anytime soon.
No.
Although I would pop huge for that.
Yes.
That would be the DC equivalent of Howard the Duck, you know, being up on the big screen, which I know excited a lot of people in the Guardians movies. But
absolutely. But nevertheless, hopefully with Wonder
Woman's Marvel
success, this will work out.
Absolutely. But speaking of Marvel, let's hop over to the Marvel side of things for film and talk about a couple of things that broke this week. The first being during the Game 4 of the NBA Finals last week, Marvel saw fit to hit us with the first trailer for its Black Panther film that I believe is scheduled to release in February of 2018. I believe that's correct. I'm going to look up that release date real quick. But Greg, I'm guessing you saw the trailer?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I did. I was very impressed.
it looks amazing.
It blew me away. I think it would – I'll go so far as to say I think it's better than any of the Spider-Man Homecoming trailers.
I would agree with that, yeah.
It absolutely knocked me off my feet. And I'll tell you how I knew I was going to like it before I even watched it, Nick. We have a mutual friend who texted me and said, I didn't really like the Black Panther trailer. And when I got that trailer, Nick, I said, oh, I'm going to love it. And sure enough, I watched it, and it was phenomenal. It was everything that I could have asked for. It just looks amazing.
That same friend was also pretty convinced that Wonder Woman was going to suck. So,
yes.
You know, what can you do there? In any event, I tell you what, I loved everything in the trailer, first of all, but I want to throw a little love to something. It's very rare for me to notice these things in movies, let alone trailers. You want to know one of my favorite aspects of that trailer?
What's
the score? The score of that film feels simultaneously orchestral and epic in nature, while also having this urban, ethnic feel to it that a Black Panther score has to have. And I thought it just added so much to that trailer.
Could be almost orgasmic, my boy.
But yeah, so yeah, I absolutely love the trailer. I mean, I haven't come across any rational person who didn't to this point. So
yeah, it's gonna be. It looks like it's gonna be. Who knows? You can't always judge off a trailer. The movie could suck, but
again,
the trailer makes it look like the movie's gonna be awesome. So
yes, and at the very least, I mean, we know at this point the movie. In the overwhelming likelihood is that the movie will be at least good because again, Marvel hasn't made a
Marvel
bad movie
doesn't
yet.
Steer us wrong, right?
They make movies that are less good than their other movies, but there is not a bad movie in their 15 film catalog to date.
They make superhero movies for the American working man because that's who they are and that's who they care about.
Absolutely. But speaking of Marvel on film, let's transition away from Marvel Studios and move it over to the X franchise at Fox, as we got a slew of announcements this past week related to the next major installment of the X-Men franchise, X-Men Dark Phoenix, confirming that Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, and Jennifer Lawrence will all be returning for X-Men Dark Phoenix. Not only that, confirming that Jessica Chastain is joining the cast in the role of Princess Lilandra of the Shi'ar Empire, and that Bryan Singer is officially turning over the directorial reins to longtime X-Men film producer Simon Kinberg. So, lots to unpack here, Greg. What do you make of this slew of announcements on X-Men Dark Phoenix?
Well, I mean, I think we all knew that Dark Phoenix was going to be the direction that they were going to go in recent...
And they had announced as much when they kind of unveiled their upcoming slate of X films for the next couple of years.
Right. I think what we didn't know, and which actually came as a huge shock, is that the cast was going to come back. Because the word was that they were at the very least certain to lose Jennifer Lawrence. But... there it is. She is signed on and she is back. Jennifer Lawrence, Michael Fassbender, James McAvoy, that kind of connective tissue that has tied the franchise together since First Class several years ago is coming back. So I think that was a big announcement. I'm happy for that. I like all three of them in their roles. I think they've all been – I think she breathed a new interesting life into Mystique, a very different take on Mystique, granted from the comics, but a version that, you know, I might argue is a little bit – less played out than the version that we're used to getting of Mystique, and definitely love Fassbender's Magneto, and McAvoy is a good Xavier, so a fan of them coming back. Jessica Chastain as Lilandra is interesting because I will not accept a Lilandra that doesn't have the Lilandra hair, if you know what I'm talking about, Nick.
I do not.
The Lilandra hair is the how to describe it? Triangular, triangular, almost like fins. If you pull up a picture of her from the animated series, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's a giant triangle with ridges in it that looks not unlike Simpson's hair. And I want to see how they can possibly get Jessica Chastain to look like that. If they can pull it off, which the Spider-Man movies were never able to pull off the Osborne basketball hair, I will give this movie a pass for whatever it does plot or dialogue-wise. I wouldn't even care because they'll have the Lilandra hair. But that being said, in all seriousness, Jessica Chastain's a great actress, so good addition here. I'm interested in seeing where this goes. I think the biggest question mark for me, Nick, well, actually there's two. One that we've talked about in the past, which is that I think it's too early to do Dark Phoenix. I think they're rushing it. They haven't given us enough of an attachment to Jean yet, this new version of Jean Grey. So that's just my opinion. And number two, Simon Kinberg has never directed a feature film, for what I can find. So this is going to be a totally new assignment for him in terms of directing. And we've seen that work at times. And then we've seen times like David Goyer where it hasn't worked.
Right.
So
I think the thing here is that even though Singer is going to move on, I think he's probably going to still stay on the movie as a producer. And I think a lot of the same cast and crew is going to be together. So I think the thought process will be he will have a lot of assistance on the film. So I ultimately think that if the film fails, it won't be because of the direction. It'll be more because of script and plotting issues. I do think that it's interesting in that, you know, we've already seen them attempt to do one version of the Dark Phoenix story with X3. And I find it interesting that they are going and trying to distinguish this so wildly by having it be, I mean, fully involve the Shi'ar Empire and all the cosmic elements of the X-Men that, quite frankly, I never thought we'd actually see in an X-Men film. I think that's interesting, and I think it's an approach. I'm not the biggest fan of the cosmic elements of the X-Men. I'll be the first to say that. But I'm kind of glad they're doing it because it shows a continued willingness
to do something
on
different.
Fox's part to do something different.
Yeah,
yeah. And
I
agree. That's the big thing. The other exciting aspect of the rumors that are out there right now is that the reported setting of the film is 1991, which is kind of the midst of the X-Men heyday. Although I would point out, if that winds up being true and the film is set in 1991, I believe that puts you at, let's see, the first X-Men First Class took place along the same time as the Cuban Missile Crisis, which would have been 1962 or 1963, if I'm getting my dates correct.
Somewhere around there,
Which would mean that 28 years at least would have passed between that film and this film. Not only that, but if you are intending it to be viewed as being in line with the original X-Men film, that would mean only 9 years of time between this 1991 set movie and the movie and X-Men, which was set in the year 2000. So my question becomes, at what point are they going to put McAvoy and Fassbender in some old man makeup? Because those motherfuckers haven't aged in like 30 years of continuity time.
Well, Jennifer Lawrence hasn't either.
But they explain that away in the first
X-Men
films,
yeah,
with the Mystique X
shape-shifting
thing.
Yeah,
so that I'm willing to give him the pass on.
Xavier's lost his hair. Magneto just still looks strapping and...
There is a long way to go from modern-day Michael Fassbender to wrinkly old Ian McKellen, and I want to know how that becomes. My theory is that he's going to try and shock Mace Windu with some lightning at some point during this film, and Mace Windu is going to reflect the lightning back on him and cause him to become horribly wrinkled at some point.
Will he shout out, "Unlimited power!"
I know, but Xavier will shout out, "Incredible power."
Power.
So,
that's right.
Similar enough.
Very similar. Well, speaking of Marvel properties, and speaking, and I know we're using "speaking of" to transition a lot here, but nevertheless,
it's our fucking show. We'll do whatever the hell we want. You fucking marks.
That notwithstanding, we want to stick with Marvel, and we want to go to the video game world.
Oh,
and what we want to talk about is the very first gameplay footage, folks. Actual gameplay footage of Spider-Man PS4. Which is a project that's been in development for quite some time and is scheduled to come out in 2018. And the best way to describe this is the same way that our buddy Russell Sellers has been describing it on Twitter, which is Spider-Man Arkham Asylum. That's basically what it is. The controls look to be almost identical to the Arkham games. And folks, I don't give a rat's ass. Maybe you can dock some points for creativity, but you need to add a billion points for execution, because this looks like one of the greatest things that's ever been invented.
It looks so insanely fun to play, and I would add that while it takes the general mechanics from Arkham Asylum and Arkham City and that franchise of games, it does, even in that little bit of gameplay footage, which we've only seen 8 minutes of gameplay from this, it does add some things that the Batman franchise didn't really do. The spider sense of slowing down the combat rather than speeding it up and actually allowing you to kind of strategically plan out your moves in the midst of a full-on combat scene rather than saving strategic planning only for stealth scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, all of those different web shooter combinations that they showed for the takedowns look amazing. The one where he throws the guy up in the air and kind of rapid fire shoots like 12 times and webs him up to the beam above him.
Yep.
Good Lord, Greg. It
looks amazing.
So incredibly fun to play. If I can pull off, I said this on Facebook, and I stand by it. If I can pull off even half of the moves they showed in that gameplay trailer with regularity and with reliability, it's going to be one of the most genuinely fun games to play I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's the only concern for me, is as someone who had trouble at times being good, what I would consider to be good at Arkham, and that I loved playing it, but I couldn't pull off some of the really cool, complicated stuff, so I found myself relying on the same combinations over and over. I would like to really expand and use some of this stuff. My favorite one was the remote web, where he would shoot the web and the guy would run by it and the web would fly out and stick him to the wall, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Amazing. I mean, it looks incredible. The web swinging looks awesome. Spider-Man 2-esque and just looks incredible. Miles Morales is apparently going to be in the game, which is awesome. Can't say enough about it, man. I am stoked for this game. It's been a while, man, since we've had a Marvel Comics console game that's really been worth getting excited over, and this is that one.
Absolutely. Marvel, you know, they said earlier this year they were making a recommitment to AAA titles for their video game properties, and this shows that in a big way. I can't wait for this. This is a definite buy for me whenever it comes out next year, so cannot wait for that.
Yeah, well, let's stick to Marvel property, or Marvel-affiliated studios, rather. It's not really Marvel. We're going off of Marvel a little bit here, but Fox, obviously, 20th Century Fox, that is tied in closely to Marvel due to the X-Men franchise. Well, they recently announced something pretty surprising, to me anyway, and something I know you wanted to talk about, Nick, and that is that 20th Century Fox Film has acquired a significant minority stake in Boom Studios, the comic book publishing company known for stuff like Lumberjanes, Mouse Guard, Grass Kings, a variety of other properties. And they've had writers such as Mark Waid. It's also the studio that produced Irredeemable and Incorruptible. So obviously a lot of well-known titles have come from Boom Studios. Now, this deal, according to Boom co-founder Ross Ritchie, will, quote, fuel Boom's generation of more original content like Lumberjanes, Mouse Guard, and Grass Kings. He says, Fox has been an incredibly supportive partner, and our creative alliance has been tremendously successful. High-level directors, big screenwriters, and marquee talent have found Boom an attractive platform. Now, Boom can greenlight more new series from comic book creators, deepen its distribution relationships, and widen its marketing reach. Now, Boom has already signed a first-look movie deal with Fox a couple years ago. And there are deals that have been announced for The Empty Man, Irredeemable, Malignant Man, Imagine Agents, Mouse Guard, and Lumberjanes. I had no idea about that Irredeemable thing, by the way.
No, nor did I.
The idea of an Irredeemable movie, I say make it happen, man. What do you make of this deal? This is, looks like it's going to help Boom invest a little bit more, pay creators a little bit better, which is good. What do you think of it?
It's interesting. I mean, that's the main reason I wanted to talk about it, just because it's so interesting to see a film studio buying into a comic company, and especially, you know, a non-Big Two comic company. I think it shows – it's great for Boom in that, you know, the additional bankroll is going to allow them to try new things, and it's great for Fox because now they're going to kind of have what Warner Brothers has. They're going to have a plethora of – you know, properties that they already will know if they're working with a fan base or not before they're ever greenlit or ever taken into production. So I think this makes a lot of sense on a whole lot of levels, and I'm hopeful that it will lead to Boom trying new things at the encouragement of Fox to try and find that next great adapted property. So this, to me, you know, I think a lot of movie studios who want to get into the comic book adaptation business should be reaching out to these smaller publishers. I think this is a business model that has a lot of potential. I don't know that it's going to work. You know, it's hard for us to say that, you know, years in advance. And I already know where you're going with that, Greg. But
to me, it
has the potential. That's all I'm going to say.
You're not saying it's going to happen.
No, I'm not saying it's going to work. I'm saying
that's not your words.
There's the possibility of this partnership having the potential to one day produce films that could be considered to be potentially successful.
There is indeed that potential. On a serious note, I think you and I both were piqued when we saw that there is an agreement to potentially, again, one day make an Irredeemable movie, which would be awesome, I think.
Yep.
So, yeah, very cool. Well, with that being said, folks, that's all we got for the rundown this week. Let us know what you think about these stories. What do you think of the future of Boom Studios? Have you read any of the content that we talked about there? Tell us about your thoughts on the Fox X-Men franchise going forward. Tell us your thoughts on all of this, the moving and shaking going on at DC and their adaptations. And tell us about some things that we left out of the show, things that we can get to next week and offer our thoughts on. And speaking of which, again, I want to give you our handles on Twitter, at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. And, of course, on Facebook at Place to Be Nation Comics. Let us know what we can do better, what we can add to the show, what you'd like to listen to, what you'd like to hear us rap about, as the kids all say these days. And I neglected to mention at the beginning of the show that this episode was once again part of Wonder Woman Month here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Russell Sellers over at Sellers Point has a couple of Wonder Woman-themed episodes already in the can, one of which, in particular, The Guide to Wonder Woman, you have got to listen to. Liam Sharp was on that one, the amazing Liam Sharp, and we definitely thank him for his time joining us on that one. So with that being said, folks, Nick, what do we have coming people's way in the next few weeks?
Absolutely. So next week we're going to wrap up Wonder Woman Month by taking by doing an edition of Countdown, where you've heard us over the last year talk a lot about the Greg Rucka Wonder Woman run during DC Rebirth. And so what we're going to do is they've released 24 issues. So we're going to go through those 24 issues and we're going to count down our top five issues of the Greg Rucka DC Rebirth Wonder Woman run, which means, Greg, you got to bust your ass to catch up over the next week so that your top five will have some validity to it, in my opinion. Then we're going to wrap up the month. June is a very special month here because it has five Thursdays, and when we have five Thursdays in a month, what do? We go giant size. And so for our giant size this year, we are presenting you with the Hathi Awards, the most prestigious night in all of Place to Be Nation Pop.
That's right. Get and your tuxes ready.
I don't want to delve too much into the month of July, but I will tell you that we are kicking off the month of July, folks, in extremely explosive fashion. You are going to want to hear this. We are bringing to you, after a two-month hiatus, the latest installment of Hard Travelers for Hire as we kick off Phase 2 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have said before, and I'll say it again, Marvel has never made a bad movie, but if you want to hear Greg and I disagree on how good a Marvel movie is, and have a wide gap in our opinion of a Marvel movie, tune into this one, because the first week of July, we are bringing to you Hard Travelers for Hire on Iron Man 3. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you now, at the end of that episode, at the end of Iron Man 3 episode, we are going to announce officially, and perhaps even hit you with a little teaser trailer for the next giant size edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, which is coming up in August. It is going to be certainly a unique situation, to say the least.
That's a good way to describe it, my friend. A unique situation in the industry. And certainly all of that is true. The Iron Man 3 episode, It's going to be the only time that the word hot will ever be associated with Nick Duke and Greg Phillips, because we'll be getting hot, yeah, folks.
We'll be getting half hot.
That's right. And other than that, we hope that you enjoy all the content. We urge you to listen to the other great podcasts here at PTB and Pop, Geek and Sassy, putting out great content all the time. Jenny and Miranda do a great job on that. Obviously, Sellers Points is killing it. Todd Weber's Conversation is back finally with part four of the Byrne Claremont examination with Tim Capel, as Todd and Tim are delving into the Chris Claremont, John Byrne X-Men run and doing a wonderful job of that, adding a lot of interesting insight and actual valuable opinions to our usually gimmick-heavy shows like the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So definitely we appreciate that. And as Nick has once suggested, he's hoping that they increasingly reduce the number of issues they focus on. As this last episode, they look at only two issues, maybe one day getting to just looking at individual panels for an entire episode.
Yeah, I think that is the natural evolution of that show, and I am all for it personally.
Me too. It's no secret how much I've dug this show. It's made me really want to actually read these comics that I've heard about my whole life but never actually read. I mostly experienced those stories through the cartoon, so really excited about that. Also, of course, we've got Lucha Undead. We've got Go Home in a Box. We've got PTBN's NBA Team podcast. We've got Top Beer, which, of course, I know a lot about, as you know, Nick. And I think that's it for right now. But, yes, we've got a lot of things on the feed. Go check them out. Place to Be Nation Pop on Podbean, iTunes, whatever you'd like. And in the meantime, I once again remind you all, and you as well, Nick, that as we softly, brother,
will tonight be the night that Bruce reveals himself to the Magnificent Miranda?
I never met a girl like you before, Miranda.
Miranda.
And I'd do anything for you if you just ask.
Miranda.
Ask me to do anything for you, Miranda. Please don't ask me to remove my mask. It's against the code of heroes. But you know how much I love you, darling, so come into my kingdom. Boy genius, what are you doing here?
Bruce, come right away. There's a job to be done. A giant octopus has run amok in Washington.
Boy genius, this is one time you'll have to go it alone. Would you like to see me make my muscles dance, Miranda?
Miranda!
For someone powerful as me, it's no big task.
Miranda!
Ask me to do anything for you, Miranda.
Miranda.
But please don't ask me to remove my mask. It's attached to my special super thermal V nuclear long underwear. I don't think I've forgotten my promise. Tonight, I'm going to kiss you.
Bruce, something terrible has happened. Mr. AC/DC, the electric brain, has threatened to turn off the electric current all over the... See what I mean?
Holy Sherlock Holmes, boy genius, you're becoming a real stick in the mud. You better zoom right out of here. I can see the hurt look on your face, Miranda.
Miranda.
So I'm gonna do the little thing you ask.
Miranda.
Come take a peek, a teeny weeny peek, Miranda. Get ready now while I remove my mask. There, darling, what do you think?
Oh, please, put it back.
Drat! I never met a girl like you before, Miranda.